And here's the problem. Within law enforcement, misconduct has been allowed to continue and has not been held accountable because they allow the officer to retire, meaning they allow them to leave the department before any type of disciplinary action comes. Now that's on their permanent record. And then what happens? They end up on the next town or the next city over in a new uniform, and it's almost all that bad conduct has been wiped away until they do it again.
Now, if you're not ready, then go ahead and tell me you're not ready.
I object to you getting records. You've been intrusive into people's personal lives.
In other words, the car didn't hit him, and he wasn't hit by the car.
I'm not a lawyer, but... Are y'all keeping up?
Debrief.
Hello and welcome to another episode of I'm Not a Lawyer But
The Debrief.
I am Melanie, aka I'm Not a Lawyer But, and I'm joined by my co-host
Gooseberry. How y'all doing?
And we are so excited to dive into today's episode. But before we do that, we want to give a thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp, and we are going to tell you more about them in the episode. On this podcast called I'm Not a Lawyer But The Debrief, we are not lawyers or legal experts or any of the above. So this is never legal advice, okay? That's what all the lawyers say on their videos. But you definitely should not take anything we say as legal advice. But we tell you about some of the things going on in the world in terms of the law, lawsuits, court trials, all those kind of things. We kind of keep up with that and then bring it to you on this podcast with a little bit of style, sometimes a little bit of flavor, many times some seriousness based on the topic that we are covering. And so that'll be a mix of what we cover today. We have two things for the docket today. We're going to talk a little YSL, and then we are going to talk about the murder of Sonya Massey, the 36-year-old woman who was killed early July in Illinois. So that will be the second part of the podcast, and we will have a guest join us, Trooper Todd McGee, who has been on this podcast before. He's going to join us and talk to us from his perspective as a retired trooper about what happened. And so let's get into it.
Let's.
So first up, YSL.
Mm-hmm. YSL.
The YSL trial. What has happened is that Judge Glanville, the original judge who has been on the case for the last 19 months, if you include jury selection, was recused from the trial. So he is no longer presiding over it. And Judge Whitaker is the new judge who has been assigned to oversee what happens next. So last week, she gave all the attorneys, the state and the defense, a deadline of Tuesday, July 23rd, to get in all their motions, because she is known to move quick. She is known to get things going. And so she told all of the attorneys, if you have a motion that you need to file, file it, because I want it in by the 23rd. I want all answers by the Friday. Okay. So if the state files a motion, the defense has to answer to it by Friday. Defense file a motion, state has to answer by Friday. And then starting next week, starting on the 30th, throughout the entire week, she plans to go through each and every motion and comb through it, make orders. And then generally she ordered that on August 5th, the jurors would be called back to the courtroom and court will continue. That is the general schedule that she has lined up. She also said a lot of things in that hearing. She was like, I heard y'all be in here acting crazy and y'all ain't finna do that. When I say 8:45, I mean 8:45. I don't mean 10 o'clock like Glanville was doing. Y'all gonna come in here and show up on time, and we gonna start on time. She told them no eating. She said, literally, she said, this is not a movie theater. We are not eating popcorn. If somebody's on the stand, we will be paying attention. You will have water. She told them that. She also told them that their clothing, she said, apparently the closet is full of clothes for y'all defendants. What, take it, get it out of here. She said everybody can have up to 5 outfits because there's 5 days in a week. And then you will clean it out and then you can bring some new ones, but you're not just going to have a bunch of outfits.
I was wondering about
that. Men are in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why they get clothes anyway?
Well, because think about the prejudice that could happen if the clients are always in Fulton County Blues.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah. But, okay. Fair.
Yeah.
But why isn't there just a closet full of white button-ups? And this is what they
provided by who?
Provided by the state.
Yeah, well,
you're large. You're extra large.
Okay, well, think about that.
Put that on.
The state pays jurors $25 a day. You think they're going to have clothing for the people they are prosecuting to wear nice white button-ups in everybody's sizes?
No. Everybody's sizes, man.
That's not happening. The clothes that you have is what you can wear.
For it anyway.
And it's already the most expensive trial, so they definitely don't have white button-ups for all the defendants.
Yeah,
but she also said, take all these clothes home. So anyway, all of that happened, and so things started moving. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, the 23rd came, and a bunch of motions were filed. There were some motions for bond, mm-hmm. right, which makes sense because these defendants have been locked up for two years yep. at this point. Of course, not having been found guilty, just locked up. Based on Glanville, he had denied some of those motions for them to be out on bond. So there are some bonds for motion. There was also a bond for a mistrial. And this a little bit ties into the mini bar for today, which is interesting. Attorney Doug Weinstein, who you all know was on, if you don't know, he did an interview on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And he filed a bond for a mistrial with double jeopardy attached. Mm. And so the reason that that matters and why that's interesting is because the way that he basically wrote out the motion is that we have been goaded into filing this motion. We don't want to because he's saying we've been winning. Mm-hmm. We're winning this case. The state has done a terrible job. And so because the state and the judge decided to have this ex parte meeting, which they knew was illegal,
yep,
they knew was not okay to do, they did that in hopes that we would find out and then we would be forced to file a mistrial because this is unconstitutional. And so because of that, according to the Supreme Court, you can attach double jeopardy, meaning mistrial this and they don't get to bring it back.
Yep.
So it's a really interesting argument. And one of the cases, I just wanted to talk quickly. One of the cases that went to the Supreme Court, it's Oregon versus Kennedy. So the man Kennedy was being prosecuted by the state of Oregon in 1982. He was prosecuted for stealing. And what happens is during the cross-examination of a witness, the state asked this witness some questions about the defendant. They asked him, regarding a rug. He had been accused of stealing a rug. And they're like, do you do business with him? The witness says no. And the state says, because he's a crook. Is it because he's a crook? Mm-hmm. So then they file for a mistrial. You can't do that. That's prejudicial, whatever. And so they said that he shouldn't be, they being the defense, the defendant, mm-hmm. Kennedy, says the state shouldn't be able to retry me because this mistrial was based off of what they did. They asked this witness this question. I wouldn't have had to file a mistrial if they didn't do this. Mm. So originally, are you following?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So originally, the state of Oregon agreed. And they said, they cannot retry him because this was what the prosecutors did. But then it goes up to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And they say, no. It has to be intentional. If the prosecutors did something intentionally, then double jeopardy applies. But if it's not intentional, it doesn't apply. And so what they said is in this instance,
this was intentional.
Well, no, they said in the Kennedy instance. No. Well, oh, you're saying why sell? So, yes. So in the Kennedy instance, the Supreme Court said that was not intentional. So mm-hmm. you can be retried. But in YSL, what Doug Weinstein is saying, they intentionally held that ex parte.
Yeah.
They did it on purpose. The judge was there. And that is why we should not have to go through this again. We were goaded. We were forced into filing this mistrial.
Now.
Okay.
obeying the law of the land.
Uh-huh.
The judge would have to approve that, correct? Because that's what happened in the past. Hold on, hold on. I also want to say you're thinking, or Doug Weinstein is thinking, that the state intentionally had this ex parte meeting and was like, they're going to find out about this and we need some time. They're going to try to get a mistrial so we can have time to recoup and then try him again.
Exactly.
But they didn't know Weinstein was going to say, no, no, no. Mistrial, but double jeopardy as well.
Double jeopardy. Before we continue on with this conversation, I want to talk to you about BetterHelp, which is one of the sponsors for today's episode. Do you have some self-care non-negotiables, things that like you have to do or else it throws your whole day off? When I don't get enough sleep, that I be off, okay? When I'm not a big breakfast person, but if I don't have lunch, I'm like all thrown off. And that happens, it'll throw you off. You're at it, you don't even know why you're mad, all the kind of, and then when your schedule is packed because you got kids activities, you got, they got schoolwork you didn't know, they have to, after school activities, it's a whole thing. But when you have an outlet, when you have somewhere to throw all of that at, like therapy, it can just help you a little bit, okay? And that's why we are so excited to tell you about BetterHelp. I personally love therapy. It's like the time in which you just, it's like your own me time, but like it's not just you. It's you being able to just decompress. You leave the sessions feeling better, feeling lighter, feeling like you can take over the world, regardless if you missed your non-negotiable thing for the day. You just feel like, okay, I can do this. It's a little bit of a reset. So I want to encourage you to check out BetterHelp. Never skip therapy day, okay? Let's include therapy as one of your non-negotiables. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/lawyer today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/lawyer.
Lawyer.
Now we're going to keep talking about what's going on in the world of legal news. I don't know that they didn't know. I mean, it's always a gamble because this is a big ask. Like asking for a judge to grant a mistrial with double jeopardy is a big ask, right? Like asking for a mistrial is big enough.
Mm-hmm.
Double jeopardy so that none of these defendants can be retried on this stuff again is a big ask. So that's what he's saying is we were goaded. We were baited. We were forced into this mistrial because they were losing and they wanted another chance at it.
True.
Yes. That's what they're saying.
So if a lawyer goes back and finds a trial that same situation happens in their trial, does the judge have to abide by?
Well, so that's the case ruling? Law.
Okay.
That's literally case law. So what happens, right, when these, in all of these motions, the way that you argue your motion to a judge is that you cite case law. You cite examples. Okay. You cite precedents that has been set by previous judges, particularly in your state, or if you can go through Supreme Court, even better, in which a judge, a similar incident has occurred and a judge ruled in the favor in the way that you want them to rule. So that is the way that you argue it. What happens though, and why anytime there's a motion, the other side gets to respond, the response is that they then argue, here's case law, here's examples, here's precedents in which it went my way. Right.
Okay, okay.
And so what happens is there's this back and forth. That's why law is always like, you'll see, because you typically can find a way to find a case that could argue. And if you're a good lawyer, you'll make it look like exactly what you're saying. And so the judge is presented that. They, of course, do their own research and readings. And then they make it hopefully an informed ruling based off of what has been presented and what they know. Does that make sense?
It's clear.
Okay.
And that's why you be running.
But that's why it's literally case law. What you're talking about.
So case law. See, I didn't know that. So case law, I thought once you presented this and it was cookie cutter, this was the ruling for this same exact crime.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you rule the same way?
Right. But
judges just get to go off of what they.
Yeah. And it's all about low key. It's a little bit about interpretation because as an example, the state argued in this case that ex parte meetings were legal, and she cited some case law in which she said that it was legal, and I'm not a lawyer, but I read the case, and my interpretation was that she was wrong. The way that she was trying to liken this situation to the other was different. This her situation happened after the witness Kenneth Copeland in YSL said, I'm not testifying. right? Mm-hmm. The case law that she cited in that case, I think the ex parte meeting happened prior to him even getting on the stand. And I think even prior to him being given
immunity.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's all about interpretation. It's all about like figuring out the similarities and the differences and then a judge ruling.
Ah.
So anyway, that was a bit of a tangent, but that is what Doug Weinstein has filed. There is mm-hmm. another motion for a mistrial that was filed by Bruce Harvey, the legendary Bruce Harvey from Atlanta, who's been practicing. He's been an attorney since the 70s, so he's very well respected. So he also has one. So next week, Judge Whitaker is going to begin ruling on some of these motions. But the other thing that happened in all of these motions being filed mm-hmm. was that the state filed a motion to basically get the defense attorneys in YSL to stop doing interviews, right? Let's pull it up for fun. So this is the state's motion to restrict extrajudicial statements. And so they are moving this honorable court to instruct the defense to refrain from making further extrajudicial statements about this case moving forward. Further down, it says attorney Brian Steele, Keith Adams, Doug Weinstein and Max Sharp have all made statements to the media explicitly discussing this case in violation of Rule 3.6. The statements have included, among other things, interviews and statements to the Associated Press. Four of those interviews have been, she gives them time lengths, 25, 33, 43, and 107 minutes in length. And they include the attorney's views and opinions about the case itself, opposing counsel, the now former judge, the jury, the outcome, and the guilt or innocence of specific defendants. And so they are saying, hey, these defendants are talking too much. And so when you scroll down, there's some exhibits. And so they give the exhibit, the example of a statement to the Associated Press by Brian Steele. There's an interview with Keith Adams. There is another statement to the Associated Press, an interview with Doug Weinstein, an interview with Max Sharp, and Exhibit F, ladies and gentlemen.
Uh-oh.
Exhibit F in the state's motion for the YSL RICO trial is, we need a drum roll, the debrief, interview with attorney Doug Weinstein.
Big Doug.
We are officially cited. We are an exhibit.
In
the state's motion.
Oh, man.
And then there's timestamps. 10:12 to 10:24, 15:50 to 1608, 1618 to 1621, 1856 to 1901. She said Doug Weinstein was on there talking.
We in the building with Big
Doug. And she said, make them stop talking. So how do you feel about that? Because what's happening?
All of this is public knowledge. Everybody's been watching the case. They haven't said anything they haven't said already in the case.
Yeah.
So I think it's wild though that we still are an exhibit. That's crazy, crazy.
100%.
I mean, like, it's in writing.
Yes.
Black and white.
Yes.
It's in the books.
We are now
records.
Our podcast is now a part of the case in some interesting way that we had not anticipated.
Nah.
And it's funny. It's wild. Mm-hmm. We are obviously going to see what happens when the state rules on this particular motion. But
what do they call us to be witnesses about Doug?
Well, they would have to call everybody else that they cited in there as well. I doubt that would happen.
I get on the stand.
They gonna hit up Kevin State Studio. They gonna hit up the producer, Leah. We need all the files. Send it to us.
Y'all really want to know what I think about this case? They gonna say, what's your name? Oh, no. How old are you? Grown.
Mm-hmm. I plead the fifth. No, so that is what happened. That is Exhibit F. We are obviously now a part of the trial in a way that we hadn't anticipated, but we will be looking forward to see what happens next week when Judge Whitaker rules on this motion and the many other motions that have been filed. So anyway, that is just an interesting tidbit. We're going to call this episode Exhibit F. That's our wrap up on YSL.
It's Judge Whitaker.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a mistrial and double jeopardy. because this paperwork she's about to go through, she's going to be like, this is.
Well, we'll see.
Just too much.
We will see. Okay, so moving on to the open bar, the part of the podcast in which we kind of talk about the main topic. And as mentioned at the top of this episode, we are going to spend time talking about Sonya Massey. And we are joined by retired trooper Todd McGee. Let's get him up on the stage.
Welcome back, sir.
Thank you. How's everybody?
Good. Good to see you. Okay, so for the audience, if you are unaware, 36-year-old Sonya Massey was killed on July 6th in her home in Sangamon County, I think is how you pronounce the county, in Illinois. She was at home, thought there was someone in her home. She called the police, in which two officers came out. And what ends up happening, there is the video footage is out. The body cam footage is out. I have the indictment, read through all of that. What ends up happening, there is an exchange regarding a pot of water that is on her stove. She is instructed to put the pot of water down. There's this exchange, and it results in one of the officers, one of the deputies, whose name is Sean Grayson, 30-year-old Sean Grayson. It results in him shooting her and killing her. And so we have Mr. McGee here joining us because we want to have this discussion. Of course, things like this have happened in America, and it generally sparks a ton of questions. And so from your perspective, we just wanted to get, well, we wanted to get your perspective and your thoughts regarding what happened. Of course, there is, like I said, a ton of questions and a ton of things, and you obviously cannot speak for every member of law enforcement that has ever existed, so that is not the intention, but just to get your insight and thoughts about what happened. So that's kind of the nature of the conversation. And to start, I guess.
I have my first question.
Oh, please.
What in your training, how do they train police officers in identifying a threat? Like, what is a threat when it comes to law enforcement?
One of the first things that are taught in the police academy is, and I was a use of force instructor. I've defended cops in court of law on their use of force. I'm also involved now in a couple of cases where I'm working for the plaintiffs where there's been police misconduct. So I'm working on both sides of the issues. So, and let me say, in my professional experience, I will never, ever put an exoneration or try to spin inappropriate police misconduct. There's great men and women in law enforcement that do the right thing each and every day. A small percentage, we need to call them out. They need to be held accountable. If that means going through court, that means going to jail, then they brought that on themselves. So, Greg, before I answered your question, I really wanted to make a strong statement on where my position is on police misconduct.
We appreciate that.
Yeah.
So in the academy, what I would teach my recruits is that hands kill. That is a universal phrase. Now, that's not a blanket phrase that you just go out on patrol with and you keep that in the back of your mind. It comes with training, and it comes with understanding body language, and it comes to understand the subject that you're dealing with, their mental capacity. It falls back on what's the nature of the call. Was there a weapon that was seen and reported by somebody? Was there am I responding to a robbery in progress? So there's a lot of factors that go on. But the first introduction into recognizing a threat is the hands. So let's, and I know you got a lot of questions, and I have a lot of things I'd like to share
and
with the
please,
audience.
Yes.
So in the case, first of all, I want to talk about this officer, Grayson.
Yeah.
Reportedly, worked for six different police departments. huge red flag.
Okay.
In a police officer's career, one of the few careers where you can stay 20, 25 years, 30 years, get a pension. To see an officer move, typically here is where acceptable moves are.
Okay.
Let's say you started off with a local municipality. Then you had a chance to go on a state agency. You're trying to increase your professional opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Usually state agencies are larger. There's more opportunity for you to become a detective, or there's an opportunity for you to work canine or specialty units, where a smaller town or PD may have 18, 30 officers, and there's just not as many opportunities for your career path. Or you make a move to a federal agency because that's where you want your career path. So those types of moves are acceptable, understandable, and essentially you would become a great candidate having municipal or state experience if you're pursuing a federal level of employment.
Got it.
Moving across the board laterally more than twice, not four, not five, more than twice is a huge red flag. And here's the problem. Within law enforcement, misconduct has been allowed to continue and has not been held accountable because they allow the officer to retire, meaning they allow them to leave the department before any type of disciplinary action comes. Now that's on their permanent record. And then what happens? They end up on the next town or the next city over in a new uniform, and it's almost all that bad conduct has been wiped away until they do it again. Here's what's been put in place to stop that. In most states have a police officer's standards and training. Along with that is called the Brady Bill. And so what happens is the post element within your state, they are the scorekeepers. They make an entry on the Brady list of all government officials, not just law enforcement. It could also be elected politicians as government employees can also make the Brady list. But for this context, the police officers' standards and training is the watchdog that when there is police misconduct, and then you're seeing all this happening, right, in the Karen Reed trial playing itself now with Trooper Proctor and this guy Grayson as well, he's going to end up on the Brady list, whether he's convicted or not. I don't see how he can't be convicted of first-degree murder. But he'll that'll be the process to make sure that his level of accountability is not just in the court of law, but it's also administratively within these local and state levels of government.
Got it. To that point, I was reading an article yesterday that even mentioned that I'm talking about Sean Grayson, was in the military at one point, and he was discharged for misconduct. And it, then in quotations, it says a serious offense. This is IPMnewsroom.org is where I'm reading it from. But I guess to the point, it's like, if this history exists. Go ahead.
Well,
when you say it's hidden, so it's not the other departments are not able to see that he had a he was discharged, or how is this? How are we able to find this, and they're not able to find this?
Improper background check. Also, the second level is, and he would have probably gone through some type of a police academy, so he checked that requirement. But then after that, and a lot of police departments around the country are short-staffed. So they may have expedited his employment process, brought him on board without doing proper due diligence. Now, again, God bless the men and women that serve in our military. And I would want to know what that discharge was and what was the elements behind it. So was it consistent with some type of aggressive behavior? Was it consistent with some type of assault on maybe another soldier, or something done inappropriately while deployed? You know, it's a long list of possibilities where that finding was assessed against him. That being said, for a police department not to vet that information, that's a flaw. And not only should Sean Grayson be held accountable for his actions. The police department should be held accountable for not doing a proper due diligence on his background check.
Yeah.
This guy was a liability.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a way to punish or cite a police department, though? I mean, you give them a fine, civilly, but who pays it? Does it end up back on the taxpayer? Because, I mean, it's a state-funded job.
Greg, that's a great point. I don't know if municipalities or states have some type of insurance protection or some type of liability coverage against lawsuits. I mean, there's people suing town, city, states for all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So it could come out of taxpayer dollars, to be honest.
Yeah.
Can you talk about use of force? Because in the indictment, the prosecutors wrote a petition. They were basically asking the judge to not allow Sean Grayson to get out on bond or pretrial release. And so in that, they included an independent investigation by, I believe, the state of Illinois, in which this expert, this use of force expert, found that Sean Grayson it was basically excessive use of force. He didn't have the right to, there was no reason for him to do what he did. And then they likened it to, the example that was given is, it was as if an officer would stand in front of a moving vehicle and then discharge their firearm for fear that the moving vehicle that they then stepped in front of was going to hit them. It was unnecessarily, but also intentional. And so that is what they likened it to. So anyway, that was a lot of questions, but I'm just curious if you can break down use of force and then your thoughts on what that expert said.
So I'm going to use stronger language.
Okay.
That was gross negligence.
Amen.
That's the highest level of misconduct within government action that can be assessed against a person. Gross negligence. And typically with gross negligence comes charges against that misconduct, as well as termination. I'll leave it at that for now. To explain use of force in layman's terms, first and foremost, you must have probable cause and an arrest. The subject is under arrest. So before an arrest is made, before handcuffs go on an individual, there's always some level of force, even if it's a low level of force. Even if someone complies, let's just say they're pulled over, they're driving without a warrant in that state, that's arrestable offense. And they say, yes, I know, my license has been suspended for the last year. And they say, okay, I understand. And they comply and they allow the police officer to put the handcuffs on. That's still an application of force, even though there's no punches thrown, there's no pushes, that's still an application of force.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
There are five levels to it. The first level is compliance. So again, there's probable cause for the arrest. I agree that I'm going to be processed and I'm going to go without a fight. So compliance is the first level. The next level starts your series of resistance.
Okay.
That second level is called passive resistance. Passive resistance, and again, an officer's actions is always predicated on subject behavior.
Okay.
I'm going to say that again.
Mm-hmm.
An officer's actions are always predicated on subject behavior.
Okay.
So a passive resistor is going to be something equivalent to dead weight. Let's say a protest.
Okay.
Protest is over. We need everyone to vacate. And then I choose not to comply to that. Okay. I'm not combative, but I'm not leaving also.
Okay.
So that's considered a passive resistor. The force that's allowed and permissible in almost all 50 states is an escort position. Essentially, it's two hands on the person's elbow and forearm, and you move them to a place where you can handcuff them and safely transport them.
Okay.
Can't use pepper spray, can't use empty hand tactics or impact, can't use a baton, nothing. Simple escort position, move the person to a place to be handcuffed, and then they're taken away for being processed.
Okay.
The third level is active resistant, walking, running, or pulling away from the police officer.
Okay.
I'm going to go back and remind everyone that this is as a result of probable cause and the person can justifiably be under arrest.
Okay.
So active resistor, walking, running, or pulling away from the officer. What is allowable then? Perhaps OC spray, perhaps taser, depending on policies and procedures.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Can't use baton, can't use firearm. I'll say this, baton, there's some advanced techniques. You're not allowed to strike, but there are advanced techniques where you could control a person's body movement with joint manipulation locks. But that's getting too technical.
Can I don't want you to lose your train of thought. I just want to make sure I'm clear on the one that you just said. If there is an encounter officer subject, okay, and this, let's say no weapons, no guns, this person does not have that, but they are fleeing, they are running. What you're saying is that what's acceptable for that officer to do, the level of force in that regard is, say, list them again?
Possibly OC.
Okay. Okay.
Pepper spray.
Okay.
Possibly taser.
Okay.
But that depends on where the taser is put in their policy and procedure.
Okay.
Some departments may move it higher up before firearm.
Okay.
In order to discharge a taser. And then other departments may leave it as a relatively lower level of force near the pepper spray option.
Okay. Okay.
So that's active resistance.
Okay.
The fourth level is assaultive. So now the subject is physically combative, punching, kicking, spitting. That type of behavior, subject behavior, is a much higher level of resistance, and the officer would be justified in using empty hand tactics, pepper spray, baton, taser.
Okay.
The fifth and final level is lethal force.
Ah, okay.
By law, the law says that if behavior is consistent leading up to serious bodily injury and or a death, then police officers are justified in utilizing lethal force.
Got it.
In this case, it doesn't match. First of all, she wasn't under arrest, so no force options apply.
That's what I wanted to go back to you saying that. Number one, she has to be under arrest, and in this instance she said help me, and then yes, when they arrived she said please don't hurt me, and yes, they said why would we hurt you? So all of the things that you listed wouldn't even apply because she was never even under arrest or suspected to.
Not one.
So Melanie, Greg, I want your audience to understand that as this scenario played out, right? Mm-hmm. Cops are called 911 every day, all day during the course of a given week, month, year. You do not invite them in your home.
Oh.
Do not invite them in your home. You can have that conversation while they're on the outside, on your front porch. That's appropriate enough to be able to share whatever information that needs to be shared. The exception is if there is a warrant. And if there is a warrant, that means that they had to go to a judge and present evidence that criminal activity is happening inside of that home. Okay. That's a completely different scenario.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Melanie, to your point, she was calling because she thought there was a prowler. That police call for service, they never should have entered into that home.
Wow.
And unfortunately, a lot of our citizens don't understand their rights.
Yeah.
With the law, our Constitution says that a person's dwelling, the homeowner, has a greater expectation of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So based on that, we exercise our rights.
Yeah. Mm. Wow.
I see these videos of the officers putting their foot in front of the front door of the person's home so the resident can't shut the door. What is a resident supposed to do then? Like, there's no warrant. The officer just got his foot there. I mean, invading the person's privacy. What can the homeowner do?
Conversation over. You can leave your foot in the door. I have nothing further, and I'm making a complaint.
Wow.
Mm. So
here's another thing. Our community is not making enough complaints. And I understand it. Mm-hmm. Todd, it's not going to make a difference. I've called before. We have to keep calling, and we have to keep calling in abundance. And until we, there's police departments here in Massachusetts that have that exact history, that their officers are not being held accountable because of misconduct. Now, they're not as egregious as what happened with Sean Grayson, but they're enough to justify a complaint. Mm-hmm. So that needs to continue to happen. There's also case studies. I can't cite any off the top of my mind, but on a federal level, the Department of Justice will investigate misconduct of police departments. But you have to imagine that's after a numerous amounts of complaints or some major incident like we'll see here.
Yeah.
Like we're talking about.
Back to this shoot in the door. Uh-huh. But by no means the resident shouldn't slam the door on the officer's foot. So just leave the door alone and go about your business. But they are not allowed in your home unless you invite them or they have a warrant.
Or they have a warrant.
Correct.
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 Okay.
And what's going to stop the behavior with the foot in the door? I'm not answering any more questions.
Okay.
You're not getting. I'm not giving you my name. I'm not giving you any name. There's no problems within this house. Mm-hmm. Now, let me give a caveat to this, because mm-hmm. this is another dangerous game that's being played in our communities. Are y'all familiar with the swatting calls?
I feel like I've heard of it, about no. it. You give us the context.
The people making up calls.
Correct. People making up calls.
Yeah.
So let's just say you and I are neighbors. I like to play you like to play your music loud. And in order to have a little bit of get back, I'm going to call 911 and say, hey, I hear, you know, some violence and I hear some screaming and some banging around in my neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. And they live at 123 Main Street. Mm-hmm. Right. So that does happen. And I'm in that case, police may come aggressively. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a one off. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times those swatting calls are directed towards schools in our different communities around the U.S. But I don't want to leave that off our conversation for today, because that does happen, and that's a very high risk call.
Yeah. Now, in that case, do they have the right to enter the home, though? Even if it is a fake call, no one's aware. Like
they should state that. And mm-hmm. here's the other thing. A lot of police departments have body cams. Those body cams should be on. That's another level of accountability.
That I wanted to, that was going to be my next question, because in this instance with Sean Grayson, his body cam was not on until afterward. The other officer, the reason that there's body cam footage is because of this other officer. When is that body cam supposed to get turned on?
There are different policies based on the department, but essentially once they initiate the call, meaning they got out of the cruiser and they're now actively on property for the call for service, the body cam comes on before you interact with in this case with Sonia Massey. The fact that he had it off all the way through, that's a violation. I'm guaranteeing that's a violation of the department. Because you had the other officer that was in compliance.
Yeah.
Yes.
And had that body cam not been on, that cover up would have went through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Guaranteed that cover up would have went through.
And that's. That's what is irritating me. All of the other incidents that have happened since the beginning of time, before these cameras were invented. I mean, so many they're instances. Doing this with cameras on.
Yeah.
Imagine what's been happening when they weren't.
Yeah.
So think about how this would have played out. Sonia Massey probably wasn't a gun owner. Mm. How would she get a gun to take her own life? Mm. Where'd the gun come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why does the ballistic match up with a police bullet?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're talking a real cover up.
Oh, see, I talk to you all day. I would.
A whole story being created in order for a cover up.
There you go.
Wow.
And there would be their word. That's right. Their word. No one would be able to dispute it.
I want to go back. I want to go back because interacting with law enforcement is scary, mm-hmm. right? Like, especially for Black and brown people in this country, based on our history, that is a very scary encounter. Even when we are the ones asking for help, we're saying, please don't hurt me. Are there things that you, I mean, you've already given us one, they don't have to come in, but like for such a daunting encounter and one that, you know, typically doesn't have happen a lot, what would you tell people? What would you encourage them? How would you tell them to behave when they are interacting with law enforcement? Do you have any thoughts?
So look, before I answer that question, Melanie, the biggest thing that's hurt law enforcement policing in the last 20 years, in the last two decades, has been technology. Mm-hmm. You don't see police officers interacting with community members like you did decades ago. So police officers don't understand and aren't distinguishing the good people in our communities mm-hmm. compared to the small element of lawbreakers.
Yeah.
When you get to know who's who in your community and take it one step further, you know them by Mr. and Mrs. such and such. Mm-hmm. That's a game changer for that community. That police officer is connected and understands what protect and serve means. Mm-hmm. I was involved in a program in Chicago, Illinois, Cook County, Illinois. It was a federal grant that was funded, and it was based on police and community strained relationships. And there were three legs to this project. The first one was training law enforcement executives about bias, about community engagement, about how to be able to connect with the community. Then the second leg was patrol level, right? Because it's different if you're not sitting behind the desk every day and you're out in the field and you're mm-hmm. seeing the different things. So the patrol level was the second piece. The third leg of the training was with the community leaders, right? These are your pastors, the people that are community activists. And we trained them up and we gave them the perspective of the law enforcement lens. Then we brought them all together. Mm-hmm. And then they got a chance to say, hey, here are my grievances. This is how when you as a police department come into my neighborhood, this is what we're feeling.
Yeah.
And then vice versa, law enforcement had the ability to say, hey, when we're coming in, these are the reasons and purposes why we're coming into your neighborhood. And we have a language and we communicate differently. And that's to be able to process information very quickly. It's not to be insensitive or rude, but it's to understand that we have a language that helps us be more efficient when we're called to do our job.
Yeah.
Right. So that whole engagement, that community engagement is essential in order for, especially on for towns and municipalities. Mm-hmm. That's some great work that can be done. That's a matter of finding space where people can sit around in a closed forum and have dialogue.
Yeah.
I've always said for law enforcement, here's how you connect with people: food, faith, family.
Mm-hmm.
Food, faith, family.
Yep.
You can connect with anybody if you put those three F's out as your way to engage a community.
Yeah. Which is so important, because one of the other things that happens many times, which is always interesting, is that sometimes the members of law enforcement aren't from these communities. They don't know these people. And so if you are entering into a space in a community that is unknown and you are being called for some event, some call that it's so many unknowns. So I understand you're on the defense and you're trying to figure things out. Like, I get that part. But if you do these F's, if you engage, if you know, if you become familiar, I can only imagine it helps you do your job better and also keeps the community safer. Like, you need those two in partnership creates a community that could be safe and police properly.
No doubt. Police properly, and you have a proactive approach, mm-hmm. a proactive mindset. Instead of just patrolling, you're looking to engage.
Yeah.
And also, here's what's going to happen. Once you develop that trust and rapport, you know what's going to happen? You're going to have the community coming to you saying, here's where the bad actors are.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't care where your zip code is. Everyone wants to be able to live without some type of criminality, mm-hmm. you know, looking out their window.
100%.
So that happens only when there's trust and rapport that's been built. But it's got to be proactive. And I'm calling out law enforcement to take that first step.
Yeah.
Yeah, there should be some type of annual, monthly type of meeting law enforcement should have with their communities. Every county should have some type of reach out to get together, complain, or congratulate something. I mean, because this is crazy. My other question about, even let's say somebody does set this up, who's in line to make sure this is being held, like all the check and balances, mm-hmm. who's making sure, I'm using this example, for like the credit card companies, if they take your information, they're supposed to be secure, a certain amount of security they give their customers. Mm-hmm. And then the check and balances come in and say, oop, you didn't do a password check, or you didn't hide the customer's information properly. $2 million fine. You know, is there somebody checking to make, well, okay. Is there somebody checking behind police officers to make sure they are doing what they're supposed to be doing? And if the police officers or the state ends up trying to implement some type of program, is there somebody to check behind them?
The first place is usually internal affairs. If there's a complaint of misconduct and there needs to be some type of investigation, it happens internally. There are times when there is a conflict of interest where the municipal agency, it's a conflict of interest for them to, I've seen things where a sergeant is overseeing conduct of a lieutenant, right? Maybe the sergeant's an administrative sergeant, the lieutenant's out in the field. And I've seen this around protests and in police misconduct, trying to secure protests. And so now there's a complaint of excessive force, and the reviewing officer is a sergeant, but there's a lieutenant that oversees that unit. Mm-hmm. In that scenario, it should be kicked up to the state police. State police should then come out and do the investigation. So that way there's no conflict of interest and they can take an objective look as fact finders. In serious levels of allegations, it comes into Department of Justice. Federal government will step in and they will take an investigation. The Karen Reed trial, you had the FBI that had inquiries about the case. I don't know that that's been held very, very tight-lipped, mm-hmm. but some of the information that Attorney Jackson and Unetti introduced in the trial was a result of that federal investigation for the John O'Keefe murder. So all that being said, there are layers, Greg, of checks and balance. Mm-hmm. Some are low level, and then depending on how egregious the situation is, it could go all the way up to Department of Justice.
I have a question kind of on that note, but it's in regards to officers. I'm going to use the word checking other officers, but there were two officers on that scene. And like we said, one officer had their body cam on, but what is because the officers also have a brotherhood in a community, right? And so you have this, but when one of you is doing wrong, for the community's sake, we want and hope that your partner is saying, yo, hey, everybody relax, like that, you know? And so what happens when one officer is doing wrong, doing bad, and there's another officer there? is that checking happening? Is it? It doesn't seem like it always does.
Great question. The terminology is called duty to intervene. And I started my law enforcement career in 1987. I retired in 2011. It was not a written policy. It was the right thing to do. And sometimes you got to pull a brother or sister officer aside. I remember going to a supervisor saying, I don't want to work with this, this officer anymore because everything's an argument on a motor vehicle stop and they're escalating. Right. So you got to have, you got to open up your mouth.
Yeah.
And as a result of George Floyd and the pressure that had come from, you know, there were a lot of things like defunding the police, eight can't wait. There was a lot of different things where policy was implemented as a result of Derek Chauvin's murder of George Floyd. And now duty to intervene is a written policy and police officers are expected to step in before things get out of hand. And obviously that did not happen. That other officer should have said, disengage, back up, holster your weapon. He could, if he felt that he was in fear of his life, I don't know how a 110-pound woman could give him that fear. But this guy, Grayson's over 6'5", 250 pounds. I don't understand how he was in fear of his life. But
literally.
That being said, that officer could have said, you know, go to taser, not your firearm.
Yeah.
And I'm not even justifying the fact that they shouldn't have been in the house. There was no threat posed. So I don't want your audience to misconstrue what I'm saying. But that second officer did not intervene, and he should be held accountable.
Yeah. That was my other statement. Them drawing their weapons as if she was reaching for a gun. She was handling a pot of water and they were clearly across the room. In training, is it just a thing taught to just, hey, them or me, you know, like pull your weapon out?
And I guess even I'm going to double down, but because you said, right, hands. Hands are important. If she was told to go get the pot, okay, because he told her the pot could cause a fire, and so that's where she goes, and her hands are visible, where is the threat? Is water? Is hot steaming? Is being burned by water? I don't even know. So, go ahead.
So there's so many wrongs with this case.
Okay. As long as you feeling that way, I'm...
Yeah, this is okay. So many things. They shouldn't have been in the house, point blank. They shouldn't have been in the house. Secondly, if you're going to go in the house, stay out of the kitchen. There's knives in there. There's sharp objects in there. Stay out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
Have the conversation in the hallway. Have the conversation in the living room. If it's a small dwelling, you can handle your business. It's July. You can handle your business from the front porch.
Yeah.
Right. So they never should have been inside there. In the second they stepped in, it was only going to go downhill from there.
Yeah.
Because they're outside the scope of the call for service.
Mm.
Prowler was not intruder. Prowler meant she saw someone outside.
Wow.
That's how I process that information.
Okay.
She saw something that she felt uncomfortable with outside of her home and then made the call to the PD.
I like that way of thinking. So stay out of the kitchen. There's knives in there, right? Is that, you know, having that way of thinking, is that our police officers being trained to, you know, hey man, you got to think out the box, you know?
So two responses to that, Greg. Police officers are taught, I'll tell you how I train my officers.
Okay.
You're constantly doing a threat assessment. You're looking around for the environment. Bad actor may come from another room. You're looking at the subject behavior. She was calm. She had a very normal dialogue back and forth. She didn't sound unstable at any point in the dialogue.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling like on a scale from 1 to 10, I'm about a 1, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. As far as feeling threatened.
Yeah.
So there's another aspect that comes into every human condition under stress. And this happens to police officers more than police officers want to admit. Mm-hmm. And it's called fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the heart and the brain have a symbiotic relation. And the heart rate goes up, the brain goes into fight or flight mode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we are not taught me or them. They shouldn't be taught that. You're taught to constantly assess. You're taught to make sure that there's no other harmful areas, no other harmful conditions in the environment that could bring harm to you. That's why you do your business from the front door, mm-hmm. and you don't enter into the dwelling, right? So those patrol procedures, I don't want to overgeneralize, but what we do here in the Northeast, you go through role-playing, you go through scenarios, you go through every kind of everything to include a weapon call, to include, because you, if you haven't seen a non-weapon call to a weapon call, how do you distinguish that in a safe, controlled environment where you can slow things down, call timeout, and then debrief in the moment?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's how we did things at the State Police Academy. I call it stress inoculation. We're going to put you through so much stress in a controlled environment, you can't get it wrong out in the field.
Yeah.
That's contemporary training.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what this guy Grayson got.
Yeah. That's what it is, training. You need to develop some type of muscle memory for this stuff.
Yes.
And that was a pot of water.
And this is why I was against the defund the police movement, because the first thing that's going to go when those dollars move is training.
It's training.
Cops have to have training. You can't get around it.
Yeah.
Right. So, I wasn't against holding any law enforcement officer or department accountable,
mm-hmm.
but you have to be able to measure the level of accountability mm-hmm. comes with oversight, and within mm-hmm. oversight comes training.
Yeah. To the point that you're making, I mean, it's a stressful job. There's a ton going on. What are the kind of ongoing evaluations that are done with officers? Do they exist? Are you passed the background check, you did the training, and now you're in there forever? Like, what happens annually, monthly, you know, biannually? What happens with officers to evaluate their mental fitness for this job?
The assessments typically come in the form of a disciplinary action. There's no review. Like in private sector, you get that job performance review.
Mm-hmm.
There may be some contemporary police departments that have that infrastructure set up, but in my 24 years, I was never given an assessment.
Wow.
And officers that had some level of misconduct, and I'm not suggesting worthy of termination or even suspension. There is a progressive disciplinary policy. So it could be oral reprimand, then written reprimand, before you start talking about days off, suspension.
Got it.
So this is what I'm talking about, check and balances, right?
Mm-hmm.
The compliance. Has this officer, which needs to be implemented, monthly testing, training, did you complete your training? Because at a regular job, you go through the sexual training,
the sexual harassment training. All the corporate training.
Yeah, all the corporate trainings.
Yeah.
An officer should go through an evaluation every year. Hey, how many times have you got complaints, or what's happening with this guy? You know, they're not even taking notes on these individuals, and they could be going crazy. I'm saying they could be going crazy because I used to work at the gas company, and I had to walk onto people's property. And when I tell you the anxiety of walking on somebody's property and they don't know you're there,
yeah,
I mean, it gets your heart.
Right.
And I'm just the gas guy, you know. I did that job for maybe 8 months. And I was like, I can't deal with it.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine an officer creeping around somebody's house late at night, and it's a and they know it's a gun call. Somebody has a weapon. Their heart's probably pounding. I mean, blood's rushing. And if you keep doing this over and over again, you need to be evaluated.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're saying it doesn't happen.
Yeah. That mental health for law enforcement is, yeah, it has historically been considered a stigma. And I know that within the state police, we had what was called the stress unit. So we had troopers assigned to a unit where troopers could go, and if there was something heavy, they were able to be able to, in confidence, confidentially be able to speak to whatever those issues are. Mm-hmm. Also, those stressors lead to drinking, abusing alcohol. I had a brother officer that got hooked on cocaine and ended up having to terminate his job because he just got addicted to it.
Yeah.
I know officers that were addicted to painkillers because, you know, they had a cruiser accident and in their back, chronic back pain. And they ended up getting addicted to opioids. So, you know, it's a tough job. It's a stressful job. Mm-hmm. There's been incidents. There were several in Florida where police officers were given a call for service and they were ambushed. So, you know, all those things come with the job. You know that. And it's not a pass in order to have some level of misconduct or to justify excessive force.
Yeah.
You're trained. You're not going out on patrol by, I'll accept the job. Okay, here's all your gear. See you in 8 hours.
Right.
You're trained, and you're trained. You should be trained as a professional and treated as a professional, and you extend that grace to your community.
Yeah. And I think what happens, obviously, we're spending a ton of time wondering about like the process behind officers, but we as civilians are thinking this is happening. You know what I'm saying? Like, we are ignorant many times to what happens with officers. I'm sure there's some form of PTSD. Their adrenaline is constantly on high. They're running and doing, but we don't even process that because we're just living our lives and today need to call an officer and expect, right, this certain level of care and professionalism and safety. Like, we just expect that. And then when we're met with the opposite, we don't know what to do. And so anyway, I just wanted to call out that we, you know, of course, are having this conversation. But to the point that you made in the very beginning, this misconduct is on Sean Grayson. Right. And so we ask questions as civilians because we want to live to the next day. But even sometimes when you do everything right, the misconduct is on the officer. There, yes. It's not, we're not saying she should have, she could have, why did she? This is all the responsibility on this officer. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing she did wrong that caused her to be killed that day, murdered.
She felt that there was a need for law enforcement intervention. That's her right to call.
Yeah.
And to your point, you're expecting someone's going to come and give you some type of answer to your call for service.
Yeah.
Didn't see anything, or we've seen someone and they happen to be a neighbor, or we made an arrest. Mm-hmm. Right. So pretty simple outcomes in this particular, you know, in context to this case.
Yeah.
That being said, you had a problem child, in the form of Sean Grayson. Mm-hmm. He was a problem. Mm-hmm. He was a problematic hire, and he was a problematic employee. Yeah. Once he got past the hiring. And again, that's why I said earlier in this interview that the police department needs to also be held accountable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, I believe somehow the police department needs training. Like you said, that's number one. Yeah, because I can't believe that you've been in the department 24 plus years and there was no evaluation type of clause in there, just out there living your life.
the only evaluation assessment we got was physical, to make sure we physically could do the job.
Yeah.
And also there was a medical. Every 2 years You had to go through that assessment. You had to qualify with your firearm every year. And in between the assessments, you did have in-service training. You had, in-service training.
I want to make one more point, because one of the other things that happens in this video is that Sonya Massey said, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus," which for many and brown, black and brown people's community, that is a phrase you hear all the time.
Yes,
and it is not taken as a threat. It is taken. If you are commenting, the way that I process that is you going, him saying, "You're going to throw this hot, steamy water on me," and you literally respond, "I rebuke you. That I'm not doing you like it is done." It's a cultural just language that we use to the point you were talking about language, right? This is just language that we use. And when you are in the community and you are interacting with people and you are a part and having conversations, you begin to learn that stuff. And so, you know, it's like when you're saying that's the bomb, right? If you are unfamiliar with that, you are like, there's a bomb. Oh, everybody hold on, you know? But when you become a part and engage in a community, you understand their lingo and you realize, oh, this is not threatening at all. This is the way y'all talk. And so what a ridiculous blunder of events.
It just shows the disconnect that both officers had. You know, this story in this unfortunate, tragic incident is about Sean Gratian's misconduct and excessive force. But both officers were there. And and so I both officers should be held accountable. Our cultural expressions and how we move is to your point, Melanie, these are our cultural context.
Yeah.
And unless you're in the community, and if you don't hear our vernacular, then you don't know how to process it any which way.
Mm-hmm.
And so for you to misinterpret it as a threat,
right?
That's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Huge problem.
Yeah. I just want to make sure I get through some of these because we've been here for a while and we appreciate you being here and being so graceful with your time. And we, like I said, just appreciate that. I just want to make sure, I know there's a lot of questions in the Patreon. What do you think about police departments having their books open so the public can see where the money is going?
Good one. So public funds, that should be handled not at the police department level. That should be held in my city here. We have a city council. We have a we have the mayor's office, and then we have the school committee. So three different branches of government, if you will, on a city level. So in our case, the police department reports to the mayor, but the funds are allocated from city council. Mm. So a public records request should be able to be provided to any individual organization that might be looking for that. Freedom of Information Act, you know, those types of approaches. So understanding where salaries are, understanding where equipment purchases are being done, understanding where subscriptions of things, licenses of things, like software, you know, to run computer systems, any type of in-service training equipment that's used and is depleted and has to be repurchased, all that stuff should be available as a public record for a public agency.
Got it. Just if you request it.
So it's available. You just have to.
Yeah. Freedom of Information Act.
You may have to maneuver a little bit, you know, around some of the process.
Yeah.
But it's a public agency, so it should be available to the public.
I wanted to. Oh, this is it's a large question. And I've been asked myself in previous jobs. And it's about implicit bias. It's about, you know, discrimination. It's about some of the things that is very visible and outward facing. And sometimes people don't even realize the bias that they have. What are, is there a way that that's being accounted for? And if there's not, do you have, this is the big ass part. Do you have, how do we, I'm going to say one more thing, even though I just set that question up, but there, I watched a show on Netflix. I can't remember the name of it right now, but there was an example that was done in which a bunch of people were hidden behind some like boards. And there was a test of like 100 people. And they were given these fake guns. But essentially what would happen is they would have these boards like pop out behind. They would have the people pop out behind the boards at kind of rapid action. And what they were testing is the 100 people, when you have this gun in your hand, who do you shoot? Who do you aim at first? Who are you pulling the trigger on? And the results of that experiment was that people were shooting Black and brown folks, right? Mm-hmm. And so the reality is, because of the history of this country, because of the way that we are portrayed in media, mm-hmm. you have all the reasons, right? There are some biases and there are some assumptions that we, when we move our hands, it is to be violent. And so all of that to say, we, I think as a country, many of us, not everybody, but many of us in this country recognize that this is the problem. How do we fix it? Is there anything being done to fix it?
So a few answers here. There is implicit bias training within police departments. I can't verify if it's check the box training or if it's legitimate walk away with some knowledge.
Yeah.
Where I've learned something. Harvard University had an assessment tool, and it was specifically around measuring bias, implicit bias. And some of the outcomes was that the human condition is predisposed to biasness of dark. And processing that information, I had a colleague of mine that helped me share, shared the link, and I took this assessment. And as a result of that experience, the word minority, mm-hmm. I changed my vernacular because minority equates less than equal. Mm-hmm. And I catch myself when I start to say it, I don't like using that word. It's not a swear word, but I don't feel that my brother or sister of color are less than equal to anybody or anything.
Amen.
So I've started on myself trying to check my vernacular and my worldview towards things to help reset that condition, if you will.
Yeah.
The N-word. I don't use the N-word towards another person of African heritage. I just, it's not acceptable to me.
Yeah.
I'd be offended if it was used around me, near me, projected towards me, towards my family.
Yeah.
So personally, I don't use that word for that same type of reason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do believe that the when you said portrayed on the media, mm-hmm. the media has holds everything together when it comes to how people perceive people of color, not minorities.
We're preconditioned, and there's a whole history behind why that is.
Yeah.
But it's alive and well today.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you know, we can see how divided this country is. We can see how people are getting clever in their language, but it's still the same way to divide and be divisive and we just got to be mindful of how the precondition looks, and it looks differently in a different lens to different people.
I want to ask this last question, and then we can give you the floor if you have anything else you want to add before we let you go. There is a lot of talk about immunity recently in regards to presidential immunity, but also when it comes to officers because of the nature of their job, the things that happen, et cetera. And one of the questions that we have is what are your thoughts on qualified immunity, immunity being granted to officers in terms of their official acts as officers.
So there, I'm going to go back to police use of force as it's mm-hmm. measured against contemporary police guidelines. Mm-hmm. The use of force continuum and what is permissible by officers to use mm-hmm. is very clear. It's not an ambiguous process.
Yeah.
And when a police officer, when their actions fall outside what is permissible, you now need to be held accountable.
Yeah.
So I am not in agreement with protections when there's criminality.
Yeah.
Right. What we saw in the Sonya Massey case, that was criminal conduct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What we saw in Derek Chauvin's behaviors with George Floyd, that was criminal conduct.
Right.
So I had an attorney that I provide expert witness testimony. And I'm going to give you an example it's a horrific example, but it was an accidental situation. There was an arrest being made on an individual. The police officer pulled his taser and one of the probes hit the individual in the eye.
Oh, wow.
And the permanent blindness in one eye.
Oh, wow.
So my response was the police department should settle out of court, or the city government should settle out of court. In that particular instance, the way tasers work is there's a cartridge with two darts that come out, and they obviously there's the battery charge and have electricity running through the probes. But when they come out, they separate. They come out together,
uh-huh.
and then they separate based on the distance.
Okay.
Right. So accidents happen. That was a horrific incident.
Yeah.
I feel for the person that went through that. But that police action, I don't see as intentional when we measure it against a Derek Floyd or when we measure it against a Sean Grayson.
Yeah.
Does the department need to be able to be held accountable or the city accountable for pain and suffering of the individual? Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Even if this person was in the process of being lawfully arrested,
mm-hmm.
right? That went beyond the scope of force,
right?
Right?
Got it.
The permissible force.
Yeah.
Right. So in that particular case, that's where I believe qualified immunity could apply and not be egregious,
yeah.
so to speak, mm-hmm. where, you know, that person that received the injury did not get their, you know, their proper justice.
Yeah. No, that was a good example. That was helpful. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to say? We didn't took up your time and ask you all the questions, which we appreciate. But is there anything you want to leave the audience with
before you start?
Oh,
I have one more question.
Yeah.
My where did it come from placing people's hands behind their backs with handcuffs instead of in the front? Did something happen to the front? And then, like, because even holding my hands back here, I'm a fairly fit individual, you know, but my breathing changes with my hands back here. And I can only imagine being on the ground with my hands behind my back. Why is that? Why? What's the history behind that? If there is, I don't know.
So ideally the objective is to control subject behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And also another Academy 101, I mentioned hands kill. A high threshold for weapons is people like to tuck things in their front waistline.
Mm.
And that minimizes, if I missed a search, a weapon in a search, knife, gun, something sharp, in the hands or behind the back, it allows me to see what's in front of the person visibly.
Mm-hmm.
I can inspect that area during a search. And if I miss it, that person's not going to have the opportunity to retrieve it quickly.
Got it. Mm.
Secondly, to your point about how you anatomically change when your hands are in that position behind your back, the technique is called prone cuffing. So if you cuff someone from the ground, police officers are trained that once they're cuffed, they're considered controlled and to sit them on their behind,
mm-hmm.
not to leave them down on their chest, because we've had positional asphyxia and that's where custodial deaths come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, especially when you introduce pepper spray, because that affects your respiratory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So the process is prone them out, cuff them up, sit them up.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then from there, when you're ready to transport them, bring them up to their feet, bruiser, transport.
Yeah. And it's just up to the officer when it's, I mean, because there's obvious people, you know, out of shape individuals, even in shape individuals, you see that their breathing is changing. And like you said, I just sprayed you with pepper spray. Your heart's pumping. It's just up to their discretion whether they put the cuffs in front of you then. Even though they check you, you know, they search you. You know, if I'm going to put the cuffs in front of you, I'm going to make sure I don't miss anything versus so there, you dying from having your hands behind your back.
That's right. And it's happened. That's real. That yeah. is absolutely real. There are exceptions. If a person has an obvious injury, you would cuff in the front, pregnant female, cuff in the front, common sense type of things. You know, it's a practice and policy for hands to be put behind the back, but it's acceptable to have those exceptions when you can articulate and you've, you know, your prisoner has expressed that, you know, hey, I have no movement in my shoulder. That's something acceptable that can be done.
Okay.
You good?
I still don't like that behind the back situation.
I want to again open it up. If you have any, go ahead.
One other, Greg. Yep. The other thing is we train with double handcuffing. So mm-hmm. sometimes you have people that have a big body and mm-hmm. wide shoulders, and they just can't. Their wrists won't touch. We mm-hmm. we train double cuffs, so it might look more like this behind the back. Mm-hmm. So it's better off for you to do that. That way, one, you're not creating unnecessary injury to the person, and two, they're going to be more compliant if they're comfortable.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. It's not about putting pain on them. It's about making sure they are controlled, but without adding any type of risk of injury to the person.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any final words for our audience before you leave us?
Just again, unfortunate situation, but you know, I really appreciate your platform for having this dialogue and in helping your members better understand what their rights are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've got to do better at knowing what those rights are. We've got to do better at researching, having dialogue, and I'm not sure if you follow some of these First Amendment audits, but you know, police officers are guilty of this as well. They don't understand people's rights, mm-hmm. and they respond and behave inappropriately because they're ignorant.
Yeah.
When you're on the receiving end, no one wants to be on the receiving end of a cell phone recording, but that's protected speech under the First Amendment. Police officer can't take the phone, can't arrest you for filming, none of that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's just another area of knowledge and information that we as a community, we got to get better at. And that's on us to be able to do that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing all of your knowledge and giving us all of your insight and perspective. It is always so useful. I think the audience, the Patreon for sure, is already chiming in how much they enjoy having you here. So thank you again for speaking on this case with us. And we'll be talking to you soon.
Great to see you both. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Bye.
Thank you to retired trooper Todd McGee for joining us. And actually, I should say, the law enforcement and security analyst, yes. Todd McGee, for joining us. We always appreciate him being here. Thank you for listening to this episode. And we also just want to say, send our thoughts, our love, and our prayer out to everyone who loved Sonia Massey. We hope and pray that she rests in peace and in love. Mm-hmm. And until next time, close us out.
Court is adjourned.